sort of something. See what extent we're on the same page. Okay. You could take the plane, usual product topology, and then it take its one-point compactification. Or you could take the one-point compactification of the line and then take the square of that and give it the product topology. What would this look like if you tried to draw a picture of this? Can you imagine a plane with a point at infinity?
Like this one?
Yes. And so, this you can actually prove it. You know, you could prove it's homeomorphic to a subspace of the three-dimensional space. Right? You can just imagine there's the plane. Basically, the easiest way to do is kind of map polar coordinates. So think about it in polar coordinates. Do something like this. You'd want to send the R at 0 here should correspond to kind of like the South Pole. And so how do you achieve that? Well, you could use like in spherical coordinates, things are usually done in terms of like a co-latitude and so on. What you would want is R goes from 0 to infinity. You would want the co-latitude to go from 180 degrees to 0. If you just did in terms of latitude, it would go from, negative 90 degrees here all the way up to positive 90 degrees here. So you just have to pick some function. I'll just write it informally. You don't have to change the longitude at all. And F just needs to be some kind of homeomorphism from this to and strictly increasing. So adding a point in infinity is like a sphere. What does this one look like? One-point compactification of the line look like?
A circle.
So what's the square of a circle? How could you represent that?
also?
No.
Surrender?
No.
I'm tempted to say a little bit of dominant, but I'm not sure why. It means like a square, a circle instead of another circle.
A donut or torus is actually correct. There's actually a figure in your book in section 7.1. It shows a circle. You know, S1 is a symbol for the circle. S1 times S1, and the illustration is a torus. Let's see if we can draw this. Okay, so you can think of it as here's one. You have kind of so it's an analog of latitude, right? But see here, latitude, it's just, you know, negative 90 degrees at the South Pole, positive 90 degrees at the North Pole. But here, you can have a full circle of latitude, so to speak, because you can be on the inside or on the outside, right? When you're talking about the surface of a donut. So your latitude has to have a whole circle's worth of coordinates. And then your longitude would be really just like it is on the sphere. Works like a product because there's just this natural bijection. It's easier to see if you imagine kind of if you kind of unwind your circle, so to speak, kind of a false picture, where really, you know, this point is the same as that point, right? So I think maybe this is the infinity point represented twice. Really, it's the same point because it's a circle. But if you kind of unwind it, it's easier to see things. And so if you imagine some point in here, right, then the basic kind of neighborhoods would be some rectangles would be a simple choice. And so you just have to figure out a way to send this circle over to a circle there and send this circle to a circle here to get your coordinate system. So maybe you want to have, for your latitudes, maybe you want to have, you know, this be the infinity latitude, say, kind of the outer equator. And then maybe zero is the latitude of your inner equator. And then for your longitudes, you have the infinity longitude, maybe that's in the front, the zero longitude's in the back. And maybe your positive longitudes are over here, your negative longitudes over there, something like that. And so once you make that thing, once you have that established, then this point should correspond to something like this. And this little neighborhood, you come along for the ride like that. Everything should be fine. Circle, right? Because if you take the real line, then you bring together the ends to have a point at infinity, then the real line what would this be?
That's a little good.
Yeah. Okay.
It's an infinitely long cylinder. Let's see if we can draw this. It has no end because the real line here has no end. It's some kind of picture like this, but it goes on forever. The sphere, of course, being if you believe that it's really a compactification of the plane, right? Then you should believe the sphere is compact, and it is. And of course, you can also think of the sphere as this closed bounded subset of three-dimensional space, which therefore is compact. Torus, you can also think of as a closed bounded subset of three-dimensional space. But if you read from chapter 7, you know that the product of two compact spaces, like two circles, would be compact. So that'd be another way of seeing it. This is compact. This, not compact. And there's actually much stronger stuff, right? Arbitrary products of compact spaces are compact. Although although once you go to infinite products, you need the axiom of choice to prove that. What's the key lemma here? The one where the axiom of choice gets used. This in the book's presentation, it's the Alexander subbase lemma. When I talked about characterizations of compactness, I stated this one as a space is compact if and only if for some subbase, or equivalently for any subbase, if you cover the space by elements of the subbase, then that cover has a finite subcover. Okay. So, you just let S be the set of all open cylinders. I think the book uses a P. I think I used a pi last time. You can use whatever you want as long as you explain your notation. So that this is just the projection to the ith coordinate. And so the preimage of an open set of a factor is just all the capital I index sequences whose particular term in this case, that lowercase I, when you look at that coordinate, you need to be in this particular set. Okay. So this is a subbase by definition of product topology. That's how I defined the product topology last time. It's all of the arbitrary unions of finite intersections of sets of this form. Now, We just need to show that if you have an open cover made for those kinds of sets, then we can actually get a finite subcover. So if I prove this, I usually like to prove it in the contrapositive form. Okay? So I show that if I've got a bunch of sub-basic open sets, but there's no finite subcover, that is, no finitely many of these covers all of X, then what do I want to prove? Then I want to prove that actually the whole thing doesn't cover X. Okay? So showing every sub-basic open cover has a finite subcover is equivalent to showing that every sub-basic open family without a finite subcover is actually not a cover. So in contrapositive form, how's this look? Now we have to actually look at the pieces. So you got to consider the kinds of sub-basic open sets you'd have. And for each coordinate, there's a different kind. So consider the cylinders over the ith coordinate that happen to be in this particular family. So this family of open cylinders here, for a given coordinate, it might not contain any cylinders over that coordinate. But in that case, this will just be an empty family, okay? Now, in any case, we have this criterion here. So for any finite subset of these, this is also a subset of the whole family that we're talking about. We have this, right. Now think about, what does this mean for the product space to not be covered by these cylinder sets? Well, since this F is a finite thing, why don't we list them? Right? So how about this? So what are these sets saying? Right? Each of these sets is just looking at the set of all points whose
ith coordinate is in a certain set. And so when we union that up, we just have really the set of all points in the product space whose ith coordinate is in the union of those sets. So you've got the product space, and it's not contained in the set of all points whose ith coordinates are in this union. Okay, but every point in the product space has an ith coordinate. That ith coordinate is somewhere, right? So if I choose some q, say, in x, but not in f, that means, which I know exists because it doesn't cover, I know that its ith coordinate is not in that family of open sets. So the picture would be something like, we have a whole bunch of factor spaces, it could be infinitely many, but then there's factor I, okay? And we have a bunch of sets, those O's. And then I've got my Q sequence, and whatever it does on the other coordinates, on coordinate I, it avoids all of those O sets on that factor. So if you're thinking about all these O's, the things we were taking cylinders over up here, we clearly see now that if we have any finitely many of them, we're not covering this factor. Because if we did have a finite cover by those sets, then their cylinders would cover all of X. Another way of saying the same thing, like I have here, if their cylinders don't cover all of X, then you've got the fact that the actual sets themselves and the factor don't cover the factor. So, the set of all sets O, where the cylinder or O is in here, has no finite subcover of Xi, but we're assuming all the factors are compact. So actually, this whole thing, the whole family, by compactness of the factors, can't have enough stuff to cover the whole factor. But again, that's the kind of contrapositive form of compactness. If you have a bunch of open sets and no finitely many of them can cover your compact space, then actually all of them don't cover the compact space. Okay. So, okay, now here I'm You have to use the action of choice, but not in a deep way for the next step. So choose. Say, I don't know, CI in XI, but not from any of those open sets that came, that we got by looking at what kind of cylinders we had. Now, the reason I have to use active choice is because if there's infinitely many indices lowercase I, then I have to make infinitely many choices here. Alright, but then the whole sequence of those C's which is, it's very tempting to just abbreviate it like that, okay? This will be in the product space, right? Because each coordinate is in the correct factor, but it totally avoids the cylinder sets. So I claim that it's not covered by our sub-basic open family, because if I have something from this sub-basic open family, then there exists an index, right, a coordinate, such that it's a cylinder. But then that cylinder, we avoid it on our I coordinate. So C is not in the set of all points in X with I coordinate in O. But that's exactly the cylinder over O. So we avoid the appropriate sets at each coordinate, and therefore we avoid the corresponding cylinders when we consider the sequence as a point in the product space. Sequences, which we think of as points in the product space, can be anything they want to be on the other coordinates. I'm regretting drawing more than... I'm just going to draw three here, because I don't want to draw the red lines over and over and over again. as long as we avoid the set in the ith coordinate, then even though there's all sorts of points in that cylinder set that agree with us on all the other coordinates, they're different sequences because those things in the cylinder set disagree with us on this coordinate. Even one coordinate disagreement is enough to distinguish two sequences.
Now, of course, the unsatisfying part about this proof is that the really hard work is kind of hidden in the business about how, oh, we only need to think about cylinders, open cylinders. I mean, in general, an arbitrary open cover is made up of arbitrary unions of finite intersections of open cylinders, which can be much more complicated. It's not too hard to show that you don't need to worry about the arbitrary unions. Just worrying about finite intersections of these guys is enough. But then showing that you don't even need to worry about finite intersections, just plain open cylinders, that takes this lemma and from Syracuse the axiom of choice. Okay. Now, if you just want to prove this for a finite product of spaces, then you don't need to work as hard. To prove something like the Alexander subbasis lemma, you don't need the axiom choice to do the proof, because you only need to make finely many choices. Picture the two lemma. Say I have two spaces. We'll just call them Y and Z to not conflict with X. And then suppose I have, say, a nice subspace K compact here. Then you consider the cylinder over K. Okay. So that would be K times Y there. Now, suppose you had then an open cover of this thing. Or more simply, just a single open set around it. Intuitively think of it as a union of open disks or something, right? If you're thinking of the plane. So the claim is that if you can do this, then you should actually be able to fatten things up. So you had your K compact there. You should be able to if you cover it by an open set, then you can actually do a little bit better. There's actually an open set around the K. Such that you're actually covering a little bit more. Thank you.
So the tube lemma is how you go, is how you prove a finite productiveness of compactness without using some trick like an Alexander subbase lemma, because it allows you to, you have some, you know, kind of two-dimensional open covering. And you could imagine that, because you could consider the case where K and Z are actually the same thing. The whole, this whole factor could be compact, right? And so then that would make the V also the same thing. So if you have this kind of two-dimensional set U here covering that rectangle, abstractly speaking, that's compact in width, so to speak, then that gives you an actual open set down here, the V. So it turns the two-dimensional open covering into a one-dimensional open covering. If U was actually made up of a union of things that, of open sets that together covered this, then you could take each of those pieces, let me come back to that later. I'm saying too much without writing anything down. Let me tell you why compactness matters here. I stated it wrong. The tube needs to go the other way today. Let me fix this. Okay. Why don't I show you what goes wrong first, okay? Tube goes the other way. Alright, so take for example just a horizontal line inside the plane. You could imagine an open set, kind of like a Gaussian in its mirror image or something that covers it, okay? Good. But the further out you go, it gets thinner and thinner and thinner. Situation like this, and is contained in, say, this kind of situation. Now, the idea is if you go out far enough, maybe you could have this open set U. It hugs the line more and more closely. So for any positive epsilon, although you could, although the line gets covered, if you try to fatten up the line, eventually, so like imagine you're fattening it up by epsilon, you go out far enough and this open set here has gotten so thin, it now your fattened line is not covered by it anymore. Okay. And the problem is you know, you just keep going further out, the open set can get thinner and thinner. Okay. And what the intuitively, if we had stopped at some finite point at both ends, then you could imagine a thin tube around that line that would have been covered. Okay. So, for example, but for all n in the natural numbers, say there exists a positive epsilon such that if you restricted this to make it compact, say by chopping it off there, if we chopped it off somewhere, then we could have found a thin enough tube to cover it. And so the tube lemma is the natural generalization of that. So I really bungled my initial statement of it. I don't know what I was thinking. Some other space y. So, this is going to become a list. Okay. So the picture is like there. Okay, so I'll make the horizontal factor compact. And over here I've got y as a point p. Give myself a little room here. There's the point p. This is the space y. This is the space k. At the product space, k times y, and then I've got a line, singleton p times y, and then I've got some open set u. That covers the line. I could have K inside a bigger space Z, but it's not going to change anything if I state it this way. You don't really. But I'll still try to make it marginally simpler. Okay.
So then the claim is there should be some set, open set V here that. This is a nice little lemma to prove because it you really use compactness and you use the definition of the product topology. Certain kind of, that has a certain kind of base. Okay. Anybody see a statement like this in the book? Even if it wasn't called the tube lemma. But today's day 21. Talk now more about some infinite products. There's a natural case to consider, a natural special case. Consider all the regular old sequences of real numbers. Okay. These sequences indexed by the natural numbers, so people often write it as n going from 1 to infinity. These are sequences of reals. You may remember with finite products, there's a bunch of different metrics, and they all give you the product topology. but with infinite products of metrizable spaces, there are some reasonable choices for metrics, but they give you different topologies. Okay. So a natural thing to try here would be something like a soup metric. Also called uniform metric. So how do you measure the distance between two points? You take the supremum. You want to take the supremum of all the distances between their coordinates, right? Well, the problem is those distances might be unbounded. And so you get infinity as the supremum, or just undefined. And a metric is supposed to give you finite distances between any pair of points. So you just do some kind of hack. Just cut off all distances at, say, maximum distance 1. Okay. Remember, topology captures what when a point is infinitely close to a set. So if we had cut off the distance on the real line to be maximum 1, that wouldn't change the topology. Because you'd still agree about whether or not you were distant 0 to some set or not for any particular point. even though you would disagree about, you know, whether you could be further away than distance one from anything. So you just cut everything off at one. That way, the distances between the coordinates will be bounded by one after this little hack. Then you can, since it'll be bounded, now we can take a supremum. Right? And you can check that this is a metric. Now, what kind of a topology does this give? It's kind of tricky, because so think about like the ball of say for any distance r that was between 0 and 1, what would it mean to, and then you had some sequence. Think about what does the ball of radius r look like. So it would be the set of all things where the supremum of the distances of the coordinates was less than r. Now, so if these coordinate distances got, maybe they don't ever equal r or get bigger than r, but maybe they get closer and closer. Like maybe they were r minus 1 over n for each n. Then the supremum would be exactly r. So it's not enough that they all be less than r. They actually have to be all less than or equal to some number strictly below r. Because if they got arbitrarily close to r as n got bigger, then the supremum would be exactly r. But we want the supremum less than r. So this is actually the union. And you could make it a, so it has to be strictly under R. So let's just say all the union, say for all S less than R, of what? Well, it would be the product, n equals 1 to infinity. So all the sequences that go through intervals at most s away from x. Now, as long as you were at most s away from x at each coordinate, then the supremum of all the differences would be less than r. Now, this is actually the same as considering the following. This a priori, this looks like a smaller set of sequences. But if for some s less than r, you're in all these closed intervals at every coordinate, right? So for every n, the nth coordinate of your sequence is in this interval. Then for a slightly larger s, you would be in this interval, right? Because if you make s a little bit bigger, then you get the endpoints of this interval become interior points for a slightly wider interval, right? So if r is 0.8 and s is 0.75, right, then this set would be contained in the set down here where you replace the 0.75 with, I don't know, 0.76 or something. And this is not going to be in the product. These kinds of sets are not in the product topology. Because in the product topology, let's call the product topology T. Okay? If I had X in U in T, then by definition, the product topology is arbitrary unions of finite intersections of cylinder sets. So something like this. And in fact, you could choose them to be cylinders over open intervals. So it would look something like this. If I get this right. And all those, and these are all finite intersections. So maybe I should rate it like k goes from 1 to ni. And these open intervals are just, you know, just reals with their endpoints. Okay. So X is in there somewhere. Okay. Now these cylinders, so that means that for all K from 1 to Ni, right? Because we're only allowed to make finitely many demands, because we're only allowed to intersect finitely many cylinder sets. You could, for the one that X is in, it would have to be in all of these. Okay. Now the key point here is that on some finite number of coordinates, you have X in there. But after those finite number of coordinates, you could change what X is, and you would still be in those finitely many cylinder sets. But you could change what X is such that it was not in this ball. So, the uniform topology is a very natural thing to consider, but it doesn't give you the product topology, because the uniform topology can tell the difference. In the uniform topology, you can have a sequence of points that
intuitively speaking, you can get close to your to some target sequence on every coordinate, yet it doesn't actually converge to it in this topology because it doesn't converge uniformly. If you can talk about sequences of sequences and talk about whether they converge uniformly or not. And that basically, in this topology, convergence means uniform convergence. Whereas in the product topology, convergence just means pointwise convergence. So think back to your advanced calculus course about uniform versus pointwise convergence. That's basically the distinction that goes on here. To wrap up my proof, my little argument here about these open balls not being open in the product topology, I know that if X is in one of these open sets, then X is in one of these pieces of it that's just a finite intersection of cylinders over intervals, because every open subset of the real line is a union of intervals. And then right here, we have this new point y, which is the same as x for long enough to keep it in those finitely many cylinder sets. But this metric here looks at the supremum of distances between all coordinates, with distances rounded down to one. And so here I've made the distance one. Okay, so it's not in my ball of radius r for any r less than or even equal to one. Okay. So what I've actually shown is that for any open subset of the product topology, if it contains X, then the set is too big to fit inside this ball of radius R in the uniform metric. It'll always have some points sticking out. If you want to capture the product topology, using a metric, then it is possible to do it. Right? There's an exercise in your book that asks you to do exactly that. Let's see. I believe it is, yes. This is seven exercise. Number 13 from section 7.2. Okay. Basically, if you have a countable infinite product of metric spaces, there is a metric that'll match the product topology, in that the open sets will be exactly the unions of open balls according to that metric. So like the special case for this would be it's kind of a generalization of the Euclidean metric, but you have to correctly account for this fact that the proctopology can only care about finitely many things at a time. So you have to make the distances between points on later coordinates become less and less important. Okay, so this product topology T is equal to the following metric. Why don't I call it? So use D there already. So about rho, where you take something like the Euclidean metric. You could also use this kind of like a soup metric or taxicab metric style of this. So like if I wanted to make it in this style, I would write it like this. Off at 1, but as n goes to infinity, I make it less important. The book asks you to do an analogous version of this, where instead of taking the supremum, you take a sum of the squares of this. Same idea. The essential ingredient is to make distances less and less important as you go to the higher coordinates. Because if you think about this open set that we considered here, right? If you could choose. See, with this division by n here, you can allow points to be further and further away. So imagine these s's were multiplied by n, right? Intuitively, you can think of this infinite product as when it's for metric spaces, what it does is it makes higher and higher dimensions less and less important. I think of them getting smaller and smaller. Similar version of this is you could take the product of interval, closed intervals that get shorter and shorter. Okay. And let's say you gave this the made them shorter and shorter, then the distinction between the uniform and the product topology collapses because everything is getting smaller and smaller. If you think about, you know, finally made cylinder sets here, it was easy to escape being distance r away by just adding one at a late coordinate. But in this metric, if you add one at a late coordinate, or even if you add a million at a late coordinate, since you can never be more than one away in each factor, that would only bump up your distance by 1 over n. So for n large enough, 1 over n would be less than r. So you couldn't escape the ball like I did here. Okay. Okay, so here's a more challenging problem for you graduate students. Prove that if I is uncountable, then r to the I, with the product topology, is not metrizable. So there's no metric that matches that topology. Intuitively speaking, if you make things scale down as n approaches infinity, where n indexes your dimension, then you can match the product topology. But with an uncountable metric, uncountable number of dimensions, then there's too many dimensions for you to decay towards zero. You'd end up reaching the limit of zero before you had gotten through all the different dimensions. Now, if you actually want to prove this, though, my hint for you would be look at stuff concerning countabilities, like first countability, second countability, separability. We talked a lot about how, when, for example, if you have a metric space, if it's first countable and separable, then it's second countable. Things like that. If you can't prove all of it, maybe you need to make some kind of additional assumption to get a proof, then at least give me a partial proof under some additional assumption. Mm-hmm. I'd still be interested in that, as opposed to just, I'm completely stumped. Okay. Questions or comments?